Congressman Obestar and his vision for transportation here in Minnesota and all across our country. We're honored and very lucky that he's been able to make time in his schedule to come and talk with us today, and I think it's very important that we heed his knowledge and wisdom on this area. With that, I just want to extend thanks to Bernie Leader, the chair of the House Transportation Committee, and all the House members for agreeing to come across the street and be part of this. I think that this is an exciting moment in our legislative process, and momentarily the congressman should be coming through that door. Can't really promise anything because, as we all know, when Congressman Obestar shows up, everybody wants to shake his hand and say hi and kind of push for their own little project, and so he's probably going to be picked off five or six dozen times between here and the parking lot.
With that,
for the members on the inside of the table, there are portable microphones at the end, so if you have questions, we'll make sure that the microphone gets around to you. The rest of the members, just make sure that we speak loud enough that the audio can pick it up. This is televised, as most of our transportation hearings are in the Senate. So, and this is more for me than anybody else, so you got to kind of watch what you say. With that, Senator Scoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just hoping that the congressman wasn't stuck in traffic.
I have it on good on my authority, my right-hand person, that the congressman is in the parking lot and he's making his way up here. So I'd just like to say a couple words about the magnitude of where we're at right now with transportation in the state of Minnesota. Bernie and I and many of the members around here, and I look out and I see a lot of familiar faces in the crowd, but we live out in greater Minnesota, and this is what it means for greater Minnesota. There's on average of about 500 lives lost on our roads every year. Over 70% of those lives are lost on rural two-lane roads. These are our township roads, our county roads, city streets, out in greater Minnesota. That's what it means to us. There's not a person here from greater Minnesota that doesn't have a story of tragedy either in their family or in their friends. And we need to rectify this death toll that we continue to create on Minnesota highways. The metropolitan area, every time that traffic gets jammed up out on 94 or 35 or wherever in the metropolitan area, that's millions and millions of dollars of lost economic opportunity that we could be capturing in this state and we're not. What's the problem with transportation? We all know what it is. It's a lack of resources. Representative Leader, myself, Representative Earhart, many other members are committed to making sure that that funding problem does not go unaddressed this year. We have proposed some hefty tax increases to try to address the problem, but the problem is over $1 billion of underinvestment every year. According to the Transportation Alliance, even with the passage of the new invest money, we're still $1.5 billion of underinvestment every year. We're behind by that much. To raise $1.5 billion every year would create quite a stir in the population. It would be another Boston Tea Party, I believe. So we've tried to lower our expectations somewhat, but we do need to get real money on the table so that we can do things. I think that gas tax is not out of the question, license tab fees, wheelage tax. We threw everything in the bill that we could think of, even an increase in bonds. Bonding's not a bad thing. We can fix a lot of our problems with bonding. The Crosstown Project, for example, Devil's Triangle. Senator Vickerman, he's not here right now, but he's got several issues out in his neck of the woods. If we're going to get past if we're going to get past where we're at right now with our transportation, we need new resources. We don't need funny money. We need real money. And Congressman Obestar is, in discussions that I've had with him and the people in his office, is very dedicated towards getting Minnesota our fair share. It doesn't matter what area of our budget you look at. The state of Minnesota is a payer. We pay in, and we don't get all the federal money back that we pay in taxes. That's just the way it is. But with Congressman Obestar having the gavel in his hand, he's committed to making sure that Minnesota's portion of those transportation dollars come rolling back to Minnesota. We all know what we need to do here. We had a great meeting last night, and I see commissioners here and several others that were at our meeting last night talking about transit options in the eastern half of the metropolitan area and in the eastern half of greater Minnesota. Senator Dibble has been working tirelessly, I would say, to make sure that all the transit needs all across the state are met. And I'm excited to have him as the chair of our subcommittee for transit in the Senate. I believe that subcommittee is doing a wonderful job. They've made visits to many of the communities, and I believe that there's one or two more hearings left around in the metropolitan area to take testimony from local officials and the residents that have to put up with the congestion on our highways and sometimes the inaccessibility to transit services. If we're not successful in passing a funding package this year that brings new dollars to the table for the Department of Transportation and for our transit services, there will be real cuts and real pain for everyone. Greater Minnesota Transit, Metropolitan Transit, and roads all across the state are going to be left unfunded. I think the time is ripe. We've got a whole host of new members in both the House and the Senate that have brought energy back into this building that has been lacking over the past few years. These are new members that put the politics aside and want to move Minnesota forward. And it doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat, that's our job. Move Minnesota forward and make life better for the people that are here today and the people that are going to be here tomorrow and every tomorrow afterwards. We're at a critical juncture right now, and I can't stress it enough. We need a funding package. It's great to have bonds, like I said earlier, to do big projects. But bonds, they don't put asphalt on the road out on County Road 1 in Goodhue, Minnesota. Bonds don't build transit services out in greater Minnesota. They're not going to build them, or they're not going to pay for the operational cost here in the metropolitan area. And that's just a stark reality. With that, I see the congressman has arrived. Congressman Obestar, please join us at the table. Congressman, thanks for taking the time to visit with us today and give us your perspective on the state of transportation in Minnesota and all across the country. I've got your resume in front of me, but it would take like 45 minutes to read, and everybody knows who you are, so welcome to the committee. Thank you.
Well, Senator, thank you very much, and Chairman Bernie, leader, thank you very much for inviting me. Thanks to each and every one for participating. If I go around the room and start mentioning everyone like you, it'll be afternoon. So I want to thank both the House and the Senate for your courtesy and inviting me. We used to do this periodically several years ago in the early 80s, and talk about what issues are coming before the Transportation, then it was called Public Works and Transportation Committee, so that we could harmonize our approaches on issues and work together in the best interest of the state. And then after a time, that just kind of dribbled away, and now there's a new reality in Washington, and I welcome the opportunity to come back and resume to have this discussion. I think each of you has a very detailed piece on what Minnesota receives in transportation, and I'll get to that in a little while. But first, let me, paint a broader picture. Nationally, the state of our infrastructure is under severe pressure in all of the modes, not only in surface transportation, but our infrastructure generally. Aviation is experiencing a 39% growth between now and 2016. That's going to put increased pressure on our air traffic control system, the en route system, terminal radar control facilities, towers, on the numbers of air traffic controllers, on the speed and capacity of our aviation technology to move aircraft efficiently and safely, and on the runway capacity of the nation's airports. In the immediate years after 2001, after September 11, airports diverted their runway capacity funding into security facilities at the nation's airports. Over $3.5 billion in capacity investments were set aside in order to accommodate the needs of security technology. The airports haven't been reimbursed. Minneapolis-St. Paul set aside over $300 million in capacity projects, some of which they have started since then, but the costs have gone up, and they haven't been compensated for it. We will have to deal with that issue as we get into the reauthorization of the FAA this coming year. Our freight movement is expected to go up 50% in the next decade, and yet the nation's 7 million trucks and 1.5 million rail cars aren't sufficient to move all that capacity. Delays in aviation are costing the nation $9 billion. And that is expected to rise to over $30 billion over the next 10 years. Every year, the Texas Transportation Institute does a study of congestion in America. They report on 68 major metropolitan areas. The cost of congestion, the congestion tax in those major metropolitan areas, including the Twin Cities, is $68 billion. That means that people are spending 3 weeks a year longer in their cars than they would if they could drive at posted highway speeds, buying 3 tanks of gasoline more than they would if they could drive at posted highway speeds. And it's a moral issue, because the name of the Lord is pronounced more often in traffic in weekday mornings than it is in church on Sundays. Yet this administration launched, the Bush administration launched a congestion initiative that fails to invest in a congestion mitigation and air quality improvement program that's already in law. They cut or proposed cutting $300 million out of transit, which is a surefire way of reducing congestion. And they failed to touch information technology, ITS systems, that we have used very effectively here in the metro area with the Humphrey Institute and the Center for Transportation Studies at the University of Minnesota. Fatalities on the nation's highways, 43,000 and climbing. 13,000 of those fatalities are due to inadequate infrastructure. Half of the locks on our inland waterway system are below capacity or functionally obsolete. One-third of the nation's 590,000 bridges, either functionally obsolete or desperately in need of rebuilding. We need $11 billion a year just to replace the nation's drinking water systems. And the Great Lakes, I'll be talking on Thursday to Great Lakes Forum in Duluth. By spring, Lake Superior is expected to be 10 inches low. That means lower lakes will be as much as 17 inches low. Harbors in the lower lakes are as much as 54 inches low, meaning that our iron ore carriers are going out as much as 6,500 tons less than capacity, meaning in the course of a season, two or three extra voyages, meaning the cost of our iron ore is going up. Why? Because we've had 15 years of high water on the Great Lakes and in the interconnecting channels. The Corps of Engineers has not had to dredge. And now that the water is low, dredging needs are a priority. We need a second lock at Sault Ste. Marie. We need to adjust the St. Lawrence Seaway to have a binational authority between the United States and Canada. We're going to address that in the Water Resources Development Act, my committee, that will soon, by mid-March, be out of committee. By the end of March, I hope to have it on the floor and have it passed and over to the Senate. On the Mississippi River system, New Orleans is the world's greatest grain export facility, yet a barge tow from Clinton, Iowa, round trip to New Orleans, takes 820 hours because they're moving 1,200-foot tows, and the locks, except for Alton, Illinois, are 600 feet in length. You have to break up the tow, send 600 feet through, send the next 600 feet through, lash it together, and send it on to the next lock. Well, we have to upgrade those locks, five on the Mississippi, two on the Illinois and Ohio River system. That also will be addressed in our water resources bill that has three times moved through the House, failed to move through the Senate. The question with all these investment needs is, phrased by Herbert Fairbanks in 1944, chaired the commission directed by Congress and asked by Franklin Roosevelt, you could see the end of World War II, to design a system of interconnected highways for the United States in the post-war era. That commission recommended the predecessor of what we know today as the interstate highway system, a system of 44,000 miles of interconnected highways. And Fairbanks said, "Those who doubt the financial feasibility to modernize our highway system and ask, can we accomplish the ambitious ends proposed, to them I say, a better question is, dare we fail?" We dare not fail. Our committee was organized on January 16th. We finally got our full complement of both Democrats and Republicans. We have 75 members on the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. It's the largest committee in the House or Senate. And I set forth an agenda in three parts: to ensure safety and security of transportation and other critical infrastructure, to invest in infrastructure to relieve congestion, to improve competitiveness, and improve the daily lives of our fellow citizens, and third, to address global climate change and renew our commitment to clean water and energy independence and environmental stewardship. Well, we have before our committee this agenda. We have the FAA reauthorization coming up. It expires this year. The administration has proposed a whole new plan for financing the air traffic control system and airport and airway trust fund and a building of runways, taxiways, and parking aprons. Instead of using the ticket tax, they propose a whole new system of fees that will amount to a cash register in the sky as airplanes move across the United States. Not dissimilar from a plan proposed by Vice President Al Gore, which I shot down in the mid-90s, and we're going to shoot this one down again as well. we have the Coast Guard reauthorization. That's an $8 billion program. Amtrak authorization expired in 2002. The Congress over the last several years and the administration have tried to shut down Amtrak. However, each time we've prevailed in the appropriation process of keeping Amtrak funded, we're going to have extensive hearings on not only intercity Amtrak passenger service, but we're going to focus on high-speed intercity rail, including the Midwest Rail Initiative, which I'll come to a little later. We are going to move rail safety legislation, Clean Water State Revolving Loan Fund. For 12 years, this legislation has been bottled up in committee. $20 billion to replenish state revolving loan funds. The administration's proposal, funding proposal for the coming fiscal year, 08, proposes to cut the funding in half, and it's already dangerously low. We have $20 billion over the next 5 years in a bill for 12 years has not moved through the committee. We held a hearing, reported a subcommittee, reported from full committee, and had this last week not been Iraq week in the Congress, it would have been on the House floor. It'll be on the House floor right after the current President's Day recess. Double the amount of revenue for Minnesota's State Revolving Loan Fund to help smaller communities build water and wastewater treatment systems and water and sewer lines. We've held 15 hearings in the last 3 weeks, reported 15 bills. Four of them have moved through the House already and on the pending in the Senate. We have the Technical Corrections Act for last year's surface transport, the 2005 Surface Transportation Bill. We passed that bill five times in the last Congress. This time we're going to do it. It's going to pass. It's going to be enacted. The President's going to sign it. So we have to get on with those investments. We have already moved a bill through the House to turn on the lights at the Department of Energy with solar power to fit the south-facing wall of the Department of Energy building with photovoltaic systems. We have jurisdiction over 367 million square feet of federal office, civilian office space, the federal government, and the electric bill is $5.5 billion to operate all the systems in federal office buildings. I thought we ought to start with the Department of Energy, turn it on with solar power, with a photovoltaic bill that I introduced, got enacted 30 years ago, and was defunded by President Reagan. Now we're going to fund it out of the Federal Buildings Trust Fund, and we will reduce the cost of the of operating the Department of Energy and set the standard for the rest of the country. We have National Transportation Safety Board reauthorization, hazardous materials legislation reauthorization. We're going to revamp FEMA in the aftermath of the disaster of Katrina and Rita. We're moving on National Levee Safety Program, Federal Maritime Commission reauthorization, reauthorizing of the Federal Economic Development Administration program, and the Appalachian Regional Commission. We've already passed through committee. We'll bring to the House floor legislation to replenish funding for combined sewer overflows for small municipalities. Sanitary sewer overflow legislation, which also expired 5 years ago. We're going to bring it to the House floor in the week after the recess. It's already through committee, and move that bill through. And the Maritime Pollution Standards Act to reduce air pollution on maritime vessels. We're going to reauthorize the Superfund, which last expired in 1994. We have a few Superfund sites in Minnesota. On the Great Lakes, we have the National Aquatic Invasive Species Act. We've been studying that for 15 years. It's time to get tough on invasive species. We have legislation that's going to impose penalties, impose an enforcement program, and stop the destruction of our clean water and one-fifth of the world's fresh water, which is the Great Lakes. That's a good start for an agenda for the committee. Now, In Minnesota, I have had distributed this summary of the of all of the programs which Minnesota is eligible under the Surface Transportation Bill enacted in 2005. When I shared this with Chairman Leader, he said, "My God, we never get this from MnDOT. They only give us three numbers." Well, there's the whole story. If Minnesota doesn't get busy, they're not going to be able to match the $4.3 billion in Federal Highway Trust Fund monies available to Minnesota under the law. Minnesota received a 46.1% increase in funding in Safety Lou over the T21 legislation. $626 million of that is in the equity bonus account. Now, I've heard from MnDOT saying, we're only getting 87 cents return on the dollar of our contribution in. But that figure is based on inaccurate or incomplete data going back to calculating years when Minnesota wasn't credited for its ethanol consumption. Minnesota and 17 other states were not being big ethanol consumers, but not credited in the Highway Trust Fund for our ethanol consumption because it was then tax exempt. And I voted for that legislation in 1990 to stimulate the ethanol fuels program. But over time became clear that states who are big producers and consumers were being disadvantaged. So in the 109th Congress, we enacted legislation to, as part of a major tax bill, to give producers a tax credit as a benefit in lieu of the tax exemption. Now Minnesota and other states are credited with their contributions in to the Highway Trust Fund. Secondly, those calculations from MnDOT do not include reference to the $626 million equity bonus account that I negotiated for Minnesota in the Safety Lou legislation, meaning this is an amount over and above Minnesota's entitlement under the several programs that you have before you. It's a bonus that we provided for states who met various criteria. Criteria for Minnesota, when I was asked at the end of the news conference, at the end of the conference report on the bill, how did Minnesota get $626 million? And look like you meet the standards. I said, because I'm the senior Democrat on the committee, and I wrote it in. Weren't any other questions? So the question then becomes, what do you do? I supported the MVEST constitutional amendment last fall because I felt that was the only available option on the table. And while there were many objections, and I heard a good deal from my Iron Range legislative delegation, who were quite unhappy about that, it was the only right thing to do. But it's not enough in and of itself. The last time we had a gas tax increase in Minnesota was 1988, and it was 3 cents. It went from 17 to 20 cents, and there it stayed for now 20 years almost. Now look at what's happened to Minnesota. Our population in 1988 was 4.3 million. It's nearly 0.2. Our gross domestic product in Minnesota was $89.9 billion. Today it's $234.5 billion. That's a threefold increase in gross domestic product. Motor vehicle registration in 88 was 3.2 million. It's 4.6 million today. Vehicle miles traveled, 36.4 billion miles traveled in 88, 56.9 billion in 06. That's a 50% increase in pressure on the roadways. We had 2.6 billion gallons of gasoline taxed in 06. Now, the revenue raised in 89 from that 3-cent increase and from the 20-cent gas tax highway user fee, I prefer to call it, was $450 million, and last year was $644 million. Now, if you had a, if you added a 5-cent increase, 5 cents, that's just a 25% increase, 20% increase in the gas tax. No, 25%. That's less than the increase in our gross domestic product. That's vastly less than the increase in vehicle miles traveled. That's vastly less than the pressure exerted on the road surface in Minnesota. You'd raise $161 million additional dollars and bring it up to $806 million for the total revenues for the state. At a 30-cent gas tax, a 10-cent increase, you'd get up to $322 million or $966 million. Now you can start investing in roads and bridges and transit systems, make our state a better and more mobile state. And I would suggest that if, in considering such move, create a trust fund, as we have at the federal level, with firewalls built around it, legislated firewalls, that the money can't be held back, can't be used for other purposes. It is dedicated only for surface transportation. I travel around my district, travel elsewhere around Minnesota, and I've traveled to virtually every state in the nation in my capacity as the senior member on transportation. People understand the Highway Trust Fund. They trust that this fee they pay will result in improved roads and bridges and transit systems. That's a pact we made with America. My predecessor, John Blotnick, was one of the five co-authors of the Interstate Highway Program and the Highway Trust Fund. And at the time, President Eisenhower's Secretary of Treasury, George Humphreys, proposed to use bonds to build the interstate system. The Congress said, absolutely not. Congress said that will enrich the bond traders on Wall Street, but it will raise costs for consumers and for states who will be paying not only the cost, but also interest on that cost of building the roads and bridges of our interstate. And instead opted for a 4-cent gas tax, user fee. It was enacted in 1956, but by 1957, it was clear that wasn't going to be enough to finance the entire system. So the administration came back, requested another cent increase in that highway user fee, and Congress passed it on a voice vote. You can't pass the prayer on a voice vote today. But that was a time when people paid attention to what is in the best interest of the nation, and not just what am I going to do this fall in the coming election. And if you do the right thing, people understand it, and they'll support you. That is what we need to do. You have here a robust investment opportunity for Minnesota. We will not revisit the surface transportation program in authorization until calendar year 09. But we are beginning in our committee now the review, evaluation, and assessment of the effectiveness of the programs we've enacted from the standpoint of reducing congestion, improving pavement conditions, and improving mobility of our society. We can afford to do no less. China has invested $100 billion in building 6 new airports and improving, modernizing 36 existing airports, and they're now launched on a program of building airports in the interior of the country, or the West, as it's called. China's engaged in a $200 billion program of deepening, expanding, and enhancing the capacity of their seaports. The Chinese shipping company, COSCO, has just launched a fleet of 10,000 container vessels. These will be the largest in the world until Maersk Lines from Denmark launches their 12,000 container vessel. But they'll be serving the East Coast. All of this comes in on the West Coast. China just completed a 2,100-mile rail line from Beijing to Lhasa, Tibet, at 14,000 feet altitude with pressurized passenger rail cars. They're underway with an 822-mile line, high-speed, 220-mile-an-hour steel-on-steel from Shanghai to Beijing at a cost of $14 billion. The French last year invested $6.5 billion in upgrading the TGV and adding new lines. Denmark invested $9.8 billion in its high-speed passenger rail system. Italy invested $6.5 billion. What are we doing in America? We're not making those kinds of investments, and we need to do that. Minnesota needs to be engaged with Wisconsin and Illinois in the Midwest high-speed rail passenger network. We can't. When I left Twin Cities in 1956 to go to a study program, a graduate study program in Belgium at the College of Europe, I took the Milwaukee 400, 400 miles in 400 minutes to Chicago. You can't even drive there in 400 minutes today. You can't fly there in 400 minutes. When I arrived in Paris and then took the train to Brussels, it was a six-hour train ride. Today, that train ride is an hour and 20 minutes. We ought to be able to do the same in America. Minnesota ought to join with Rudy Perpich, dead. He started the initiative, and then it just dropped out after he left the governorship in 1990, partnering with our neighboring states, Wisconsin and Illinois, in the Midwest High-Speed Rail Initiative. We ought to move ahead. And what we need, then, in final thought, is a transportation network in Minnesota that, as Al Tinklenberg envisioned it in his last submission, which I thought was the best plan in the whole country, to connect greater Minnesota with exurbia, suburbia, and the metro area, to remove the bottlenecks, but to look ahead at the transportation needs down the road, not just where we are today, and to look at improving the cost, reducing the cost of logistics. In 1987, the cost of logistics and moving people and goods in America consumed 17% of our gross domestic product. Last year, that was down to 9% of our gross domestic product. That's an $800 billion savings in a $12 trillion economy. But now it's starting to move in the other direction because we are not investing what we need to do nationwide, nor are we investing what we need to invest in Minnesota. You have a huge job ahead of you, both committees. I thank you for the opportunity to be with you, and I'm glad to answer any questions you may have.
Mr. Chair?
Well, just a second there, Senator Olsen. This is one of our new members, Congressman, and I was talking earlier about the energy that our new members have and have brought to the table, and as you can see, he didn't disappoint. But first, I want to recognize the Majority Leader, Representative Sertich, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Murphy and Chair Leader. I want to thank you for allowing my constituent the opportunity to come to his state capitol today to testify on an important issue. School is definitely in session at the state capitol today, and I want to thank Chairman Oberstar for providing us with the insight that we need. Something I hear around the capitol all the time, and not just from individuals from the 8th Congressional District, as Congressman Oberstar delivers for Minnesota. And we, quite frankly, have dropped the ball. And I'm just a guest on this committee, so I only have one question. I'm going to shut up and allow you all to have at it. But, Mr. Chair, when you, your father worked with his hands in the mines in northern Minnesota. You've talked about the economy and the effects on the economy of transportation in all its forms. Can you touch just briefly, so on the other business end of this, the construction side, the business side of building roads and rail, and the effect that we can have on that with proper investments as well?
In the surface transportation program, in just considering what happened at the end of the last Congress when majority failed to pass the regular transportation bills and instead sent a continuing resolution, the reduction in funding, had it passed for this fiscal year, would have meant the loss of 2,150 jobs in the construction sector in Minnesota alone, 192,000 jobs nationwide. We were able to prevail on the Appropriations Committee and fully fund transportation, highway and transit accounts of the Highway Trust Fund, so Minnesota will not lose that allocation. But in the aftermath of T21 in 1998, we created 3 million construction sector jobs nationwide. In Minnesota, there were 157,000 net new construction jobs in the cement finishers, the laborers union, the operating engineers, the iron workers tying the rods. I would go to the union halls and the building trades and find no one sitting on the bench. They had everybody working. That's what it means. Those are not temporary jobs. That's a career. That is the career that they've chosen to be, a carpenter, a bricklayer, a cement finisher, a backhoe operator. And those are good-paying jobs. Those are jobs that put the kids through college, pay the bills, buy the RVs, buy the snowmobiles. And we need more of those jobs. And that's why we have to have a second lock at Sault Ste. Marie to improve that bottleneck. The Davis and Sabin locks are way inadequate. They just can't handle it. The Poe lock is 110 by 1,100 feet, has 1,100 feet of capacity. The next generation Laker is going to be longer. We need a bigger lock at Sault Ste. Marie for safety and security purposes. And we have to accelerate the dredging on the interconnecting channels and in the ports on the Great Lakes so that our taconite carriers can go out carrying 60,000 tons instead of 54,000 tons.
Thank you. Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Congressman Oberstar. MnDOT, earlier this year, sat at this very table, representatives of MnDOT, and were talking to us about MnDOT, and I was able to mention to them that their 20-year plan for Highway 8 between Forest Lake and Taylor's Falls, one of the deadliest roads in Minnesota, you know, we weren't even on the 20-year plan, but we had kind of a secret weapon, and that was Congressman Oberstar. And they talked about their innovation, and I was able to point out that we now have the most powerful man in transportation is a Minnesota congressman, although Murph said he was kind of rated up there too. But
he is.
But I think it's very important that, you know, you are in a position, you were able to bring so much money back to Minnesota, not just the 8th Congressional District, so I appreciate that. But now you're in a position to bring us so much more, and it seems like I don't want to set up a battle with MnDOT. I don't think it's MnDOT it's per se. It may be some leadership. That they claim to have innovation, but I don't think they're going to. It seems to them, or what they told this committee, it's hard for them because it's not in the plan. You know, you're bringing us $63 million, but we didn't plan for it. So now what do? We send it back to the Highway Trust Fund? That's where I think we're running into trouble. You are the engine that's bringing all this money here, and I want to let you know personally that I appreciate it, and I think 95% of the Minnesotans appreciate that. But we need help getting that message out, that we want to work with MnDOT and the governor, but we don't want to send a dime back to the Highway Trust Fund. Those are words I took from you, by the way.
Well, we don't want you sending money back to the Highway Trust Fund, as was done during the Ventura years. We sent $175 million back to the Highway Trust Fund. It looked like the goodwill industry of transportation funding, and people all across the nation were happy to take that money and use it elsewhere. But I just want to point out, Mr. Chairman, that this. Otsego County did something extraordinary. Last year, they voted to bond the county to match the funding that I designated for the overpass at County Road 17 near Wyoming to build this overpass and accommodate an intermodal facility that will eventually be the Rush Line commuter rail and relocate the bicycle trail and the Sunrise Prairie trail. That should have been a MnDOT project. But the county board, Commissioner Olsen, Commissioner Robinson, Monska, and Lindbergh, others, all took that on themselves. That's a state responsibility. You have a partnership. You had the courage to step forward and pass that bond resolution. Now we've got another one going over 95 at North Branch. I've seen mothers pushing carriages on that overpass with no shoulder, no sidewalk, no space. It's a formula for fatality. We did fix that. I designated $50 million for the Union Depot out of national mega project funding that Minnesota didn't have a claim on. Designated to restore the glory of Union Depot, make the Twin Cities a great intermodal transportation center. And now the state is dithering over whether to match the available funds and build it, upgrade it. Do it. Just do it. Invest it. If you haven't got enough money, then raise the user fee. I've seen this state administration send fee after fee. You know, a fee is spelled T-A-X.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Congressman. It kind of brings to my point in this discussion that about 30% of our local property taxes go towards road funding. And in the townships, it's even more. It's about 53% of the township's budgets go to fix roads. And there's a lot of townships out there that just can't do it anymore. And there's a lot of units of government out there that can't do it anymore. And I believe it's our responsibility to help them fill up their coffers. Representative Hortman, you had... Can we pass the microphone down? See, it's that energy I'm talking about. Thanks, Senator.
There. Thank you for everything you've done on transit and in particular the North Star Commuter Rail. My question is about the Federal Transit Administration and funding for transit projects. I'm wondering if you're looking at changing the way that agency is funded, providing them with more resources, or looking at the process by which they're evaluating projects. My understanding is that some people are opting not to use Federal Transit Administration funding because it adds 30% to the cost of the project and then only matches 50% of the cost of the project. I think you had alluded to the fact we need congestion mitigation and we need to reduce global greenhouse gas emissions. Transit does both of those things, and I was wondering what your plans are to improve FTA and the funding.
We're going to start with a very vigorous oversight of the operation of the transit program. That will be done this year. We'll then set the stage for the next authorization period. But in the current law, the bill that left the House had a requirement for 18% of funding out of the Highway Trust Fund to go to transit. I started with 20%, and it had to negotiate downward. By the time we got through with the Senate, it was back and forth. It was cut. We wound up roughly about We started with 20% in the House, and we had to compromise to 18% with the Senate. And now the administration proposed a $300 million cut in transit funding for fiscal 08. Well, that's not going to fly. We're going to stop that in the appropriation process and restore the funds. But if the United States did as most Western European countries do and had a 10% mode shift, to transit,
we would save the equivalent of 550 million barrels of oil a year. That's the amount we import from Saudi Arabia. In fact, many European countries, industrialized nations, are well above. They're closer to 20% in transit. As I said, with high-speed rail, you can cut a six-hour trip to an hour and 20 minutes, you're making a huge impact. And we have to make that investment to connect the downtowns of Minneapolis and St. Paul, to move the Red Rock project, the Central Corridor, the Rush Line project, the North Star commuter rail. And I am disappointed that BNSF has, slowed things down. I'm going to have a woodshed session with them this week. But absolutely. And we need to be more bicycle friendly. And why burn 8 barrels of oil a year when you can burn up 86,000 calories a year on a bike?
It's healthy for everyone. We're going to go to Senator Dibble, Representative Nelson, and then back to Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much, Congressman Oberstar, for being here. If we could spend another minute on transit, along with Representative Hornstein, who chairs the subcommittee on transit, and myself, we're taking our committee around the metropolitan area in greater Minnesota to hold town hall meetings and field hearings just to get a sense of what the metropolitan area and beyond's vision is for and what their level of interest is for transit. And I'm happy to report that the attendance has been incredible. The energy, the ideas, the personal stories have been really great. So clearly the momentum, the interest, the public is, as we've said many times, way ahead of us on this. And I think we see the evidence in recent elections and the folks who are really taking this issue up around here. You're uniquely positioned. You see what's going on around the rest of the country, and we keep hearing about, Denver planning for and implementing multiple lines at a time, Charlotte, North Carolina, all these other metropolitan areas and states really planning and putting down rail lines and other forms of transit investments. What qualitatively is the difference? You just talked about a number of the lines that are on the drawing boards here. People are pretty excited about them, but we're not looking at getting any of those done for many, many years, and we're certainly not talking about paying for the operating that we are trying to pay for the lines that are up now are stealing from our bus system. So what's going on in other places that's not going on here?
Thank you for the question, and there's one point that I failed to had it in mind, but I talked too long. And that is the cost-effectiveness index by which the Federal Transit Administration measures and evaluates projects. They crafted this new formula in the course of our consideration of Safety Lou in 2005 and tried to apply it in order to knock out several new starts that were pending for Congress to authorize. We disregarded that formulation and authorize those projects. Nonetheless, that was the House and Senate acting together. We are going to have a hearing in which we evaluate in the public the CEI, Cost Effectiveness Index. It makes comparisons that I think are not valid, uses assumptions I think are not useful, that in fact are skewed by the administration simply to stop transit projects because they're not a transit-friendly administration. And so we're not going to accept that, just rolling over. Now, every new light rail start has more than tripled its original projections of use. Most futurists are dead wrong. They overstate. But in transportation, our projections are vastly outpaced by actual usage. And in St. Louis, and the MAX line in St. Louis is projected to have 12,000 riders a day. They're well over 58,000 riders a day. In Sacramento, the South Line, 6.8 miles, goes through the Hispanic, African-American, Southeast Asian communities. On its opening day, I was out there for the dedication 2 years ago, on its opening day, removed 3,200 vehicles from the roadway, provided transportation for an additional 2,700 people who either walked or cabbed or carpooled and who didn't have vehicles themselves. That is a very, very high impact. And there are many other stories I can go all across the country with such reports. But holding these projects up in part is this cost-effectiveness index. Secondly is the unwillingness of the administration to fully fund transit. And we're going to lay the groundwork for an increase in transit funding in the next authorization.
Thank you. We're going to go, let's see, Nelson, Sieben, Jungbauer, Ornstein, Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Congressman. And I also want to thank you for the good word you said about the construction workers. I'm a carpenter myself, so they do provide good jobs for good people to pay their bills with pensions and health care, which we need in this country. But I guess the question I have here is I'm hearing from you, what you're saying is that we're leaving money on the table in Minnesota that we could get from the federal government. Yet when we hear from MnDOT, they're saying that they're getting their full allotment of dollars from the federal government. And I guess what's the straight scoop there, and what do we need to do to claim that extra money that seems to be out there?
Minnesota has borrowed ahead on its highway trust fund account and is having to pay back from their allocations. So if you take to build a highway today and you take from the future allocation in order to do that roadway today, tomorrow you don't get that money. And Minnesota has participated in the State Infrastructure Bank Program, SIBS as it's called, which allows the state to take 10%, I won't go into all the categories of it, but take 10% roughly of its federal allocation, put in a revolving fund, and then pay, so taking money out of their allocation from the Highway Trust Fund, putting it into a revolving loan fund, using the loan fund to build projects, and then pay off the loans with future revenues from the trust fund, so you're paying interest in replenishing the loan fund. Now, I think that's about $171 million that Minnesota has put into its state infrastructure bank. That has, of course, its adverse effect. Now, MnDOT, Brad Larson, told me that Minnesota is no longer borrowing against the future. Maybe that will help.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Chairman Murphy, and thank you, Congressman Overstar. I appreciate your comments very much about the CEI and how you're willing to help reevaluate that. In a bonding committee hearing last week, the Met Transit, and Chairman Bell was before us and talked about the Central Corridor and how the connectivity to the Union Depot was, in their opinion, an option on the table. They may look at not connecting the Central Corridor all the way to the Union Depot to try to save costs, in their opinion. And I was just wondering if you could please comment on the importance of the Union Depot as the transit hub for the state of Minnesota. Obviously, it's critically important, in my opinion, for the Central Corridor, but it's also really important for a high-speed rail, and I so much appreciate your support for that line that will come up along the river through Chairman Murphy's district and into the Union Depot. And then also, it's important for the Red Rock Corridor and other lines. So I was just wondering if you could maybe expand on your support and the importance of the Union Depot and your vision for transit in Minnesota.
Thank you for your question. 3 points. One, I designated in Safe TLU 1/3 of all the planning funds for transit for the whole country for the state of Minnesota. The other third was my call to make. They weren't interested in transit on the other side, and so I designate 1/3 for New Jersey, 1/3 for California, and 1/3 for Minnesota to help with the planning of the Red Rock, the Central Corridor, and the Rush Line. Second, I designated $50 million out of mega project funding. This is national money off the top of the whole transportation program for Union Depot for Minnesota. That's money that doesn't come out of Minnesota's formula, which Minnesota didn't ever have any entitlement. I want to see this great work of art, this great intermodal, multimodal facility become once again a hub of transportation to move people the most efficiently possible, to connect with the Greyhound bus, connect with Greyhound bus. That's, you know, that started between Chisholm and Hibbing.
Everything started between Chisholm and Hibbing.
Bus Andy Anderson, you know. And my father was a great bus. He said, we never owned a car. He said, if you can't walk there, take the bus there, you don't need to go there. passenger rail systems, I talked earlier about the Milwaukee Road 400, and to connect with the ultimately the Hiawatha Light Rail through the Central Corridor, and the rush line moving on north. I think this, and you would also connect with the North Star Corridor, which really ought to go all the way to Little Falls, and someday when we do the next transportation bill, it will. That connects Minnesota. That's what we need is connectivity in this state, mobility. And to shortchange those investments, I've talked with Chairman Bell. I've had two sessions with him, one out here in the cities, and then just last week, I think it was, he was in my office in Washington. I think that the cost-effectiveness index that that USDOT, Federal Transit Administration, has imposed on this line is way overstated and is a deliberate attempt to slow the project down. But we're going to have a session with FTA about this, and then we'll expose their policy in public hearings.
Thank you.
Thank you. Congressman, the next question is from our lead Republican, Senator Jungbauer, and I'm sure it won't be on transit.
Well,
because he shares your passion in aviation. That's.
Thank you, Senator Murphy. And Congressman, you know, I'd like to tell the members that it's really scary to hang out with congressmen and senators and stuff when you're younger. I should probably bring it to my office, but I have a picture of Congressman Oberstar and I in Washington, D.C. in 1975 together when I got to ask the congressman some questions along with Hubert Humphrey and Walter Mondale. And here we are today, a little older, a little wiser, working on a lot of the same issues together. And it's pretty exciting. You were very encouraging back then, and maybe that's one of the reasons I never got politics out of my mind. I don't know. You've been a great advocate for general aviation, Congressman, and we so appreciate that. You alluded to some of the new changes that the FAA has talked about and talked about hopefully killing those the way you kind of alluded that way. I was hoping you could kind of expand on where you think the vision of the consistent funding and things need to go with FAA. Are we on the right course? Do we need to just change some of those fees within the same course we're on, like we would do a gas tax with our transportation?
Thank you very much, Senator. That is, we have not yet received the plan or proposal of FAA for its future funding of the air traffic control system. But what has leaked out in little bits and pieces, you know, there are no secrets in Washington,
yeah.
And is to me a hodgepodge scheme. To shift the costs of the air traffic control system in such a way to create great disparities. The FAA and the Bush administration would propose, instead of the airline ticket tax, which air travelers pay, that's 10% of the value of the ticket. It goes into the Aviation Trust Fund for building runways, taxiways, parking aprons, for the modernization of the air traffic control system, and for 80% of the operation of the system, meaning paying salaries of air traffic controllers. You want to convert that into a system of fees, and it's not clear yet whether these would be on weight of aircraft, distance flown, or time in the air traffic control system. Now, here's how it would operate. You take off from Washington, D.C. You're under the control of the tower controller, the ground controller. Departure control is called. After the airplane leaves the ground, You're in the hands of the En Route Center, Washington Center, way up in Leesburg, Virginia. So you pay a fee for the tower controller, departure control. You pay a fee when you enter the En Route system. When you leave the Washington Center, you go into Cleveland Center. You pay another fee for entering Cleveland Center. From Cleveland Center, you go to Chicago Center. You pay another fee for entering Chicago Center. And then you come into Minneapolis Center at Farmington, and then you eventually come down. And then you're in the terminal radar control facility, pay a new fee for entering the TRACON. And then you're on the ground, and you pay for the ground controller and the tower controller. The airlines supposedly are going to pay that fee. Who are they going to charge for it? They're going to charge the air traveler for it. And there'll be that fee will be hidden. It will not be readily apparent to the air traveler. Now you can look at your ticket and see what the fee is. The air traveler pays the airline ticket tax, pays the passenger facility charge that the airport has imposed to do its modernizations, pays the security segment fee as well. You're paying all of that. Airlines aren't paying that. They're collecting those fees, depositing them in a bank, collecting the float, and every 3 months they remit the money to the federal government. So they're making money off collecting the money. Now, second part of this is they want to get at general aviation. They divide general aviation into corporate aircraft, jets primarily, and piston engines. They have one tax for avgas and another tax on corporate jets. And it's not clear how that's going to play out. So, if you can follow all the stuff that I just laid out for you and your heads aren't spinning, then you get the Air Traffic Control Award of the Year. My head is spinning, and I don't think my colleagues in the House are going to swallow this. Mm-hmm. By the time we get through with the hearings, I hope they won't.
Thank you.
We have to be out of the room by 2:15. We've got six more people that want to ask.
Shorter answers.
Oh, no. Shorter questions. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much, Congressman Oberstar, for being here. You had mentioned at the beginning that global climate change was one of your three goals, heading out this year as the chair. And I just wanted you to elaborate a little more on the transportation sector and global warming and what you see happening in Washington, D.C. in your committee and maybe in cooperation with other committees on this issue.
I mentioned earlier that we've already passed a bill through the House, subcommittee, full committee through the House, to the Senate. I know that the Senate is going to act on it because I've already had a conversation with Chairman Barbara Boxer of California to turn the lights on at the Department of Energy with solar power, with photovoltaics. Now, the energy bill of the federal government in just civilian office space is $5.8 billion a year. Just turning on lights, running elevators, escalators, computers, and anything else that uses electricity in federal office buildings. We can cut that down. We can cut that substantially. The energy source is free. The sun provides it for us, even on an overcast day. So with this pilot project, we're going to move to a broader initiative of using the Department of Energy as a template, retrofit all federal office buildings, or future fit them, I call it. Secondly, transportation as a sector consumes 60% of all the fuel we import in the United States. We have to accelerate our use of renewable fuels, such as ethanol, not only from corn, but from switchgrass, as my colleague, Chairman Colin Peterson, Chairman of the Agriculture Committee, says, and will. Together we're working with him, his committee, to provide that initiative in the reauthorization of the farm program. We have encouraged the development of the green goat, the switchyard engine, locomotive in switchyards by the railroads that runs on biodiesel from soy. Runs with all the power of fuel oil, but with none of the particulate, and none of the CO2, SO2, or other emissions from those. So the testing, I think, is proven out, and whether we can apply that form of biodiesel to long-haul train service remains a question, but with more effort, I think it will, and we can do. Shifting to transit, a greater proportion of our Federal Highway Trust Fund monies. I think it ought to be closer to 25% of the in the transit account of the Highway Trust Fund, and make that get us to the 10% mode shift that is doable, that is feasible, and it will save us 550 million barrels of oil a year, the amount we import from Saudi Arabia. Those are just a few of the initiatives that we're working on.
Yes, Congressman, our the new allocation of buses that the Met Council are going to buy, half of them will be flexible. We're making strides there. Magnus.
Thank you, Congressman, for showing up today. I really enjoyed your discussion so far. I've got a few things I want to toss by you, and I notice on some of the information I've been getting that there's been a tremendous amount of earmark funds, projects and funds going on in transportation. The numbers I'm getting in 1987, there were about 152 earmarks totaling about $832 million, and that has increased now to 2005 with the Safety Lou program to 5,680 earmarks, Congressman, and totaling $21.7 billion. And just building on some of your previous comments, I represent the southwest corner of the state, and I'm a farmer, and we're seeing probably the largest paradigm shift in agriculture since the invention of fertilizer and in hybrid seed corn, when we look at the energy components now of agriculture and producing corn for ethanol, producing soybeans for biodiesel, and further processing our crops here and livestock here in Minnesota, exporting less of them, but further processing them here. And I want to ask about some of the earmark potential for areas of the agricultural, the prairie range, not my friend, the good friend Representative Surge's Iron Range, but the prairie range. And I note that Congressman Waltz has been appointed to your committee. And I've got a long list of earmark projects here for Minnesota, but I'd sure like to see more of them go down to that area, especially the southwest part of the state, where we're looking at the largest pork processing facility in the United States at Worthington, biodiesel plant and soybean processing plant in Brewster, ethanol plant in Heron Lake, ethanol plant in Bingham Lake, ethanol plant in Lake Crystal, beef processing plant in Windham, and we're facing an intermittent four-lane road there on Highway 60. So I would encourage Representative or Congressman Oberstar to recognize that there is indeed a paradigm shift in agriculture.
You're quite right. I appreciate you raising that. And the nation desperately needs the ethanol and other and biodiesel fuels, and not only ethanol but methanol from cellulosic fiber. We are going to make the improvements on the locks on the Mississippi River, for example. Upgrade the five locks that are now 600 feet, make those 1,200 feet, and we move that bill through the House later or early next month, early in March. If we can take 60 hours, which we can do, off the round trip from Clinton, Iowa to New Orleans, that will mean a three-day sail. That will reduce our cost of moving grain and moving export commodities. You look at Brazil, which is challenging the United States for soybean production. Recife, which is a major export facility in Brazil, is 1,200 miles further out in the Atlantic Ocean than is New Orleans. I mean, New Orleans is on the Gulf. It's 900 miles further out in the Atlantic than any East Coast port of the United States. That is a 5-day sail. We have to do everything possible to make our goods more competitive by reducing the cost of grain, which moves in international markets at as little as an eighth of a cent a bushel. Making that investment on upgrading the locks is a first step. On the transportation projects. Now, ethanol, we do not yet have pipeline capacity for ethanol because it's corrosive to the existing pipelines. We have to build either stainless steel or otherwise lined pipelines. Meanwhile, they have to move by tank car on railroads or tank car over the highways. In Tampa Bay, Florida, a 50 million gallon ethanol plant, which I visited just recently, is under construction. They're going to move it by barge down the Mississippi, by ocean-going tug from New Orleans to Tampa Bay. And then by truck and rail to serve southeastern United States. So you're right. We need better access to roads. We have a process by which we allow members to designate projects in the transportation bill. It's a 22-point questionnaire that we send out to each member to list the project. They have to show that it's within the STIP, within the surface transportation plan for the state, that it can be completed within the 6-year authorization period of the bill, that it meets several other criteria, and they have to sign it. And we allocate a dollar amount for each member for him or her to designate for his district based on what their priority. Why do we do that? You know, I'll tell you, we're not potted plants out there in Washington, and you're not potted plants here in the state legislature. You do the authorizations. You raise the revenue. You vote for the taxes or the fees. And then the state DOT gets to decide where that money's going to go, and that's all done objectively. You know, if that were the case, we'd still be killing people on Highway 8 in Chisago County in my district. There are 57 people died in 15 years, and never once did MnDOT designate Highway 8 as a high-priority safety corridor. Until I said to the folks, well, show me that there's a need. Show there's a concern. I'll come join your meeting. 850 people showed up. They stayed from 7 o'clock till 1 a.m. One after another told us horror stories. People being killed, uncles, fathers, brothers, sisters. So I designated funds to improve that road. We've had one fatality in the last 5 years. So it was whatever was done in your district was done by your member of Congress at the time, Mr. Gutnecht, I suspect, and whatever he designated was done by his decision. And I'll work with Mr. Walz, who's on our committee, and we'll have a very substantial allocation when we come around to the next office. I just want everyone to understand, these are not like earmarks on an appropriation bill done in midnight or 1 a.m. The project has slipped in and nobody knows where it came from or where the hell it's going. These are all listed. This is one of the questionnaires. Now, I'm going to take this opportunity to say that MnDOT has complained that we designated projects. But this is the letter that I received from MnDOT. January 31, 2005, enclosed for consideration our Minnesota Department of Transportation reauthorization project request forms. They filled out our committee forms. They asked for $1.3 billion worth of projects in my district, only three of which were also requested by the county board, the county engineer, local state legislators. I respond to them, to their needs, to their perceived needs, not to what happens within 494.
Thank you, Congressman, and we have plenty of roads like Representative Magnus is talking about, and the road up in your neck of the woods, Highway 14, that runs through Owatonna and clear over into my district, clear over to Winona, is in the same killing field. And we just don't have enough money right now to get it fixed. So maybe you'll get a letter from both the chairs here today on Highway 14. Oh, and Highway 60 needs money too. So, with that, we've got about 10 minutes left. We've got we'll get as many of these questions as we can. We've got Senator Bonhoff, Representative Kalin, Representative Morrow, Senator Olson, and Representative Hausman. So, Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's wonderful to see you here, Congressman. Thank you. I hear your excitement about rail, and as any of my colleagues will tell you, I share that excitement. It's the thing that I'm most passionate about in my work on the Transportation Committee, maybe my work in the Senate. And I represent the western suburbs, so I take that MinPass lane into work, but I authored a bill last session and then again this session to look at that 394 corridor for transit. And in fact, the mayor of Wayzata came and testified on behalf of that bill and talked about the old Wayzata Depot and what how wonderful it would be to have the existing BNSF rail be a commuter rail project that would, you know, go all the way out to the Wayzata Depot, make that come alive again, and then go beyond. Because I agree with you that it's not about the metropolitan area. It's about connecting all of Minnesota together once again. And there is something magical about rail and the opportunity of connectivity that that brings that's very different from any other mode of travel. And so as we look at our funding package, I know it's been talked about, should we do what some of the other states have been doing? I know Senator Dibble mentioned, you know, how come these other states are so far ahead? And we know Denver, Seattle, Portland, they did the referendums where they put a sales tax. And so some people have thought, well, should we do a regional sales tax? And my concern is if we do it that way, then we're again focusing on a very small segment of Minnesota rather than all of Minnesota. What do you think about the idea of a transit tax and the possibility of having the whole state come around to participate in that? Is that something that you think is something that might get done, or do you have an opinion about
You're
that?
You're quite right about the I don't like the term because it's, in a sense, pejorative, but balkanizing of transportation across America. It does refer to the homeland of Mr. Sertich and me. but it is an apt description. If we had not had the vision of Dwight Eisenhower, who followed on that of a pioneer in both President Roosevelt and Mr. Fairbanks that I cited at the beginning of my remarks, dare we fail? Dare we fail? He saw the need to connect, Eisenhower, the whole country together. But if it had been financed by bonds, as was originally proposed by his Secretary of the Treasury, we'd be somewhere around 30,000 miles of interstate by now instead of the 46,000 miles of interstate. So the world's most... The interstate is 1% of the nation's highway mileage, carries 26% of the vehicle miles traveled in America. Last year, we passed 3 trillion miles of vehicle travel in America. 3 trillion miles. 26% of it's on the interstate. So if you go by local tax issue, by local tax issue, you will not have interconnectivity, my concern. And the Highway Trust Fund gives us the opportunity. It was a great fight, a huge fight in 1970, I think it was, let's see, yeah, 70, to get a quarter of a cent out of the Highway Trust Fund for transit. And by the time I was elected to Congress, we were up to 2 cents. Now we're dealing at 18.5% of the Highway Trust Fund for transit. We need to be up higher than that. And we need to increase the highway user fee. Again, I said in Minnesota, just measure the gross domestic product. In 1988, it was $89, almost $90 billion. Today, it's $235 billion gross domestic product. That's a tripling. But transportation hasn't paid its fair share, hasn't benefited from that growth. And it's transportation makes possible most of that growth. Transportation creates the mobility to move people and goods. We have the greatest mobility of any nation in the world.
Thank you.
I can elaborate on it. Thanks enough for the moment.
Representative Kalin, and then we're going to call it quits.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chairman Oberstar. It's an honor to see you in these halls and to call you by your appropriate title that you've well earned. Before, you mentioned about leadership being looking after the best interest of your constituents, not looking forward to the next fall's election. And I think having knocked on about 22,000 doors in my community the last couple of years, I think transportation cuts across party lines. It cuts across partisanship and political games, and it's really a kitchen table issue. And I just want to thank you for sticking your neck out. And without you, I don't think we'd be here. But I can, in this situation of about with a golden opportunity as a state to step forward and to make this needed investment. But I can just tell you that my constituents, and I think all over Minnesota, were hearing that they're frustrated by the false choice between leaving money on the table, the federal money that you're delivering, and higher property taxes, leveraging those property taxes to make the investment to match the funds. You know, we need to make this. I think you're presenting us with this opportunity and this challenge for the state to be a partner. And I'm hoping that the folks around this table are willing to say yes, are ready to make that investment. And, you know, I'm the son and grandson of public school teachers, and I can tell you the number one thing that our teachers are telling us is they want 5 or 10 minutes more with their students at the table with their parents reading at the end of the day. And I thank you for helping make that possible, and I think it's time for us to step up to the plate and match it with you. And any opportunity and any feedback and wisdom and guidance you have along the way as we move through the session, I welcome it personally, and I know that our committees will as well. Thank you for coming.
Well, thank you for your kind and thoughtful words. And I appreciate it. But your district, your portion of Chisago County is the fastest growing in the state, 39% population growth. And they're commuters, by and large, as in Isanta County. And they deserve efficient transportation. People would much rather make that commute in a high-speed rail or highly dependable high-speed bus project that has no stops for at least a couple of the morning runs and the return runs in the evening. But we can do that in Minnesota. We can make Minnesota a transportation-friendly state. We just have to step up to make the decisions. And using the highway user fee is the most the proven most effective way to do it. Rudy Perpich had to first stand forth and say, let's do it. Other states have done. Minnesota is one of only 5 states in the nation that has not increased its user fee in the last 20 years, one of only 5. Other ones are Hawaii and Alaska. I forget, Wyoming, I think, is another one. That doesn't make any sense. And don't be beguiled by congestion pricing and by tolls. The first toll system in the Western Hemisphere was approved by King Edward III in 1348 when he gave to one of his knights the authority to build a bridge over the Thames River and to charge a fee therefor and to retire the cost of that bridge when it shall have been paid for. In 1748, Parliament rescinded the toll. Mm-hmm. We don't need to do that. We shouldn't do that in Minnesota. Congestion pricing simply means that those who have to drive to work to their trade, to run their backhoe, to tie rods in a highway project, have to pay it. They have no other option. That's not right.
Well, thank you, Congressman. The state of Minnesota definitely doesn't have a toll road mentality, and I don't think that we're going to be moving there anytime too soon. Once again, thank you very much for taking the time out of your schedule to be here. And thanks to the crowd that gathered. I mean, we've got a distinguished crowd of commissioners, city council members, mayors. I could go on and on and on. But thanks again for being here. And if you could withstand the temptation to grab the congressman on the way out the door, he's on a very tight timeline and just needs to sprint now. So thank you very much, and thanks to the members and everyone for being here today. Thanks again, Congressman.
Thank you.